I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I am Sunil Dasgupta. 2 months to go to the new session of the Maryland General Assembly, and we bring you a conversation with political scientist Stephen Rogers of St. Louis University, who has a new book out, Accountability in State Legislatures, which is published by the University of Chicago Press. It is not often that we veer away from the Washington, D.C. area, Maryland, and sometimes Virginia. But this book speaks to the reason behind the podcast. If we are to hold elected officials accountable, we must know what's happening in state and local politics. And because we don't, accountability is, well, I'll let Stephen Rogers tell you the whole story. Two interesting arguments Rogers makes is that federal political trends tend to swamp state issues, and that state government is something of a donut hole between federal and local. What's one big cause? You guessed it, media coverage. You're doing the right thing listening to I Hate Politics. I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are dirty, messy, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society functioning precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. composer, songwriter, and pianist Oren Levine. We are pulling music from his album, Making Up for Lost Time. Barbara Papendrop and Aaron Myers on vocals, Lionel Lyles on tenor sax, and Herb Scott on alto sax. You can find more music from Oren Levine at ohljazz.com. In the news this week in Rockville, Monique Ashton defeated Mark Pershala in the elections held November 7th to become the new mayor of the city. Kate Fulton, Adam Van Grack, Isola Shaw, Marissa Valeri, and Barry Jackson won seats on the city council for the first time, and David Miles won re-election. The city also voted down a ballot question to lower voting age to 16, allow non-citizens to vote, and the creation of new district representation on the council, as opposed to the current system of at-large citywide elections for all council seats. Rockville passed the ballot question on term limits, and now limits city council and mayors to 3 consecutive cycles. This leaves Tacoma Park with the unique distinction of the only jurisdiction in Montgomery County with the lowest voting age and non-citizen voting privileges. In Gaithersburg, council members Neil Harris and Rob Wu won re-election, and Jamil Hernandez joins the city council for the first time. Perhaps the most striking feature of local elections is the super low turnout. In Rockville, 12,000 people voted in a city of 67,000, three-fourths of whom are above 18. In Gaithersburg, the numbers were even lower. As of November 7th, 4,200 ballots were cast. There are 37,113 registered voters in the city of Gaithersburg, which has a population of 69,000. Again, three-fourths of whom are above the age of 18. That's a turnout of 11.32%. Now, it isn't the case that turnout used to be high in the past, but is now low. Super low turnout in local elections has been a persistent problem over decades and really is a feature of these local elections, not a bug. In the case of Rockville and Gaithersburg, there have been debates about moving city elections to presidential or gubernatorial years for the piggyback effect from big name races. But standalone city elections do help keep partisan politics at arm's length from city politics. Though, truth be told, the elected leaders of most municipal governments across Montgomery County are overwhelmingly, and maybe even all of them, registered Democrats. There is a great deal of political science about whether low turnout indicates alienation or satisfaction. And the economist and geographer Charles Thibault famously wrote in 1956 that people vote with their feet, choosing the local jurisdiction they want to live in. The turnout implication of the argument would be that people would rather move to a jurisdiction where they were happier over trying to change things in jurisdictions where they are unhappy. While moving between Montgomery County and Frederick or between Rockville and Gaithersburg is less costly than immigration, which involves moving countries, there are nevertheless costs. And if you think of how our participation in a community is itself a value proposition, this is not a small cost. So why don't people participate in local elections? We will talk more about this issue with our guest, Stephen Rogers, next. But consider how hard it is to tell the differences between local candidates. Where races are nonpartisan, there is no party identification to help with differentiation. Where there is one-party domination, such as in Rockville and Gaithersburg, there is also no party identification to help with differentiation. So for a voter to make a positive choice of candidates to vote for means spending time and effort finding out about issues, uncovering expert views and data, and then weighing comparative narratives from the different candidates. It is entirely unrealistic to expect John Q. Public to want to do that for the purposes of only one election. If a person goes to the trouble of acquiring this level of knowledge, then they are political nerds like me. Then, given the lack of issue differentiation, campaigning in local elections defaults to identity politics. The best possible way to say this is to point to the logic of balance. Male and female, white, black, brown, rich and poor, and geographic balance, if nothing else quite works. The Rockville ballot question on representative districting is about geographical balance that would create separate electoral districts in the city in order to achieve a balance on the city council. In Gaithersburg, east and west of the city are quite different. Compare the socioeconomic attributes of Quince Orchard High School students and the socioeconomic attributes of Gaithersburg High School students to see how dramatic the difference is. Dropout rates in Quince Orchard are less than 5%. At Gaithersburg, it is 13%. The free and reduced meals number, the farms number, a measure of poverty, shows 36% at Quince Orchard and 59% in Gaithersburg. Inequality often means identity politics becomes important, and ethnic and racial and geographic balancing becomes an election issue. Both the Rockville and Gaithersburg councils are very well balanced in this regard. But the politics of balancing identity can limit the appeal of political participation to the very specific groups that benefit from such politics, rather than making the universal case for participation. The most puzzling aspect of these elections was actually some large loans made by Rockville mayoral candidates to their campaign. The November campaign finance report shows Mark Pershela, who lost the election, lent his campaign $90,000 in the month of October. That is over and above the $33,000 he had lent his campaign earlier in 2023. Monique Ashton, who won, lent her campaign $35,000 in October and about $9,000 in 2023 before that. Pershela spent a total of $85,000, while Ashton spent about $35,000 in total. Ashton was also part of a slate with council candidates Kate Fulton, Marissa Verleri, Isola Shaw, all of whom won, and Paul Scott, who lost. It is unclear how much money was spent by the slate. But think about this. How much does money actually matter in local politics? The war in Gaza continues to play out in local politics. Gustavo Torres, executive director of the immigrant rights group, CASA, issued a statement on behalf of the organization which expressed solidarity with the people of Palestine, connecting their plight to U.S. racism and global decolonization. And he rejected the notion, and I quote, that any act of violence can justify the heinous practice of terror currently unleashed by Israel in Gaza. The statement has led to widespread pushback. First, Montgomery County Council member Andrew Friedson came out strongly with a retort, calling CASA's statement inflammatory, inaccurate, deeply offensive, hurtful, and divisive. Following Friedson's statement, the county council's two Latino members, Natalie Fanny Gonzalez and Gabe Albernoz, who have both worked with and received support from CASA, denounced Torres's statement as divisive and ill-informed. Several members of the Montgomery County Legislative Delegation, Senators Will Smith, Brian Feldman, Cheryl Kagan, Jeff Wallstriker, Craig Zucker, and Nancy King, have released statements condemning CASA as well. Local blogger Adam Pagnuco has reported that CASA receives millions in grants and contracts from Montgomery County and the state of Maryland. And this financial support is now jeopardized, with political leaders saying they don't want to underwrite hate towards Jews. Meanwhile, in Rockville, a small protest of local social justice groups demanding ceasefire in Gaza were met with disturbing pro-Israeli counter-protesters with deadly rhetoric of their own. Caution. The words and slogans can be upsetting, and you may like to remove young children from your shot.
ISIS. Hamas is ISIS. You're so- support ISIS. ISIS killed Americans. You want to kill Americans. We are part of this nation. Go away! Go away! Go away! Go back to Gaza! Go back to the place you came out of! Go away! You will never win! Never win! Because we are right and you are murderers! Go away! Go away! Go back to where you came from! Go! Go! You are not welcome here! Brooklyn is my town! Fuck off! Fuck off! Go away! I don't care! I don't care! I don't care! Nazi! Nazi! Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you! Don't touch me! Move your...
Get your hands off of him.
This footage was made available to us by Our Rights DC, a Washington-based direct action human rights group with mainly queer membership. They were a participant at the protest in Rockville. It is said that truth is the first casualty of war, not only because the fog of war is obscuring, but also because we start our narratives where it suits us most. And we are forced often to pick one. War sorts us out so we can't see beyond the start of our own narratives. If anything, the local controversies over the war in Gaza shows how much we differ on what the truth is. You are listening to I Hate Politics. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I'll be back with Stephen Rogers of St. Louis University and author of the book, Accountability in State Legislatures. Timely, as Maryland prepares for its next legislative session in 2 months.
I'm helpless. I'm hopeless. I walk around the house. It makes no sense. I'm feeling in a bind without you. Confusing. I'm losing my grip, so I sit and stop moving. I'm not in my right mind without you.
Stephen Rogers, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on your new book, Accountability in State Legislatures. This show is predicated on a similar set of ideas around accountability and how voters interact with that accountability. And sometimes they come around to hating politics. Let's start with the central notion in your book. Why is there so little accountability in state legislatures?
I think this is a story not only about voters, but it's also about elites, in which, so for example, on the voter side, only about 11% of voters know who their state legislator is. And only 60% of voters know which party controls their state legislature. So if you think about elections in this kind of reward and punishment framework, where you're going to reward those in power for doing a good job with your vote versus punish those in power for doing a bad job, if you don't know who's doing a good or bad job, it's going to be pretty hard to reward or punish them. So that is like part of the story. Another part of the story itself is that elites don't necessarily help the voter out too much with accountability. So, for example, over a third of state legislative incumbents who run for re-election do not face either a primary or general election challenger. And so what this means is that a third of state legislators just win re-election by signing up. And so voters don't even have an opportunity to vote against whoever's running in the state legislature because there's not enough candidates running. Additionally, there is a lack of media coverage of state legislatures. So, for example, since the turn of the century, there's about a third fewer reporters devoted to covering state government than there were back in, say, 2000. And then here we're at levels when we kind of look at number of full-time reporters. There's more people who are credentialed to cover a typical Super Bowl than necessarily covering all state governments combined.
So we have in political science the idea of the cognitive miser, right? That we don't want to spend time on things that don't matter. And even if they matter, we are looking for, and I think you mentioned this in your book, heuristics. So the question really is, how important is that knowledge to be able to operate on it? I mean, shouldn't party identification, for instance, allow you to do that?
Yeah, so party identification, you're exactly right, is going to be doing, can do a lot of work. I study elections for a living. There has been more than one election when I've got into the ballot box and kind of been like, I don't know who that person is, but I see that they're a Democrat and then I can vote for them. This is going to work a lot of the time, but at least there's probably a couple problems with this. One problem with it is that just because you have a Democrat next to your name or D next to your name, that doesn't necessarily mean you're doing a good job necessarily. And so in this, like, maybe there's like certain policies that you're passing that your constituencies actually don't want that are just kind of being sneaked into bills. Or maybe you're not even showing up to the legislature that much to actually do your job. And so in this, if you just kind of rely on that D or R next to the name, that is a form of kind of, say, being a cognitive miser or like reducing the resources you're using. But there's not much incentive then, if we're all just kind of voting D or R, not looking at what they're doing, in terms for those who are serving in office to actually do a good job. Because if they know their district, for example, is going to be 60% Democrat, 40% Republican, that Democrat in that office would be like, yep, I can kind of do whatever I want. As long as I got the D next to the name, I'm good. Another tricky part of it is that in our system of government, what does it mean to be a Democrat, for example, in Alabama, versus what does it mean to be a Democrat in Massachusetts? They're both going to be left of, say, the Republican parties within their states. But here, a Democrat in Alabama is probably going to be, is, well, we know, is more conservative on average than the Democrat in Massachusetts. But in this, when we have this kind of like large federal system where voters seem to be kind of getting their evaluations from in terms of what the parties stand for, is at this national level. So in this, when you may be thinking about what a Democrat is, a lot of people may be thinking of Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, or AOC. My book is called Accountability in State Legislatures. But for interested listeners, there's another book called The Increasingly United States by Daniel Hopkins. And what Dan Hopkins does is very nicely lay out how increasingly our politics have become nationalized over, say, the last, say, 50 to 70 years. In this, when individuals are kind of thinking about politics, what they're thinking about is they're not thinking about that Tip O'Neill saying all politics is local. Instead, they are thinking, it's like, when I think of what politics is, I'm thinking about what's going on in Washington, D.C. However, there's a lot of important stuff happening down in our state capitals. And this is becoming even more evident kind of with the recent Supreme Court rulings, whether to be on abortion or guns. And so in these state legislators and state houses are making very important decisions that are affecting all of our lives. And so it may seem to be rational to be a cognitive miser a little bit about, it's like, well, I don't really need to care about the state legislature. But the state legislature is going to determine whether or not a woman is going to have the right to have an abortion. It's going to choose how much education funding there's going to be probably in your state. They're going to handle most of the infrastructure that's probably happening in your state, like kind of in roads or bridges. And so in this, it's really affecting your everyday lives, but most voters aren't really paying all that much attention to it.
So what about an alternative view on this, which is that state and local government are not good laboratories of democracy because state and local government officials have some special wisdom, but because we can actually move from one to the other. What if the argument about in favor of local and state government being effective is that we make it effective by voting with our feet?
No, so that is a very attractive part of federalism. in which like we do have these local entities, and then here people can be attracted to maybe certain states. Like, so even I'm talking here today from St. Louis, Missouri. In Missouri, the state government is pretty Republican. Like, they have like super majorities. We have a Republican governor. But literally, if I were to go about 4 miles east, I'm in Illinois. Illinois state government is not very Republican. Like, it's much more blue. And so then I could move with like boat with my feet, cross the Mississippi River, and then be in a more blue state. And so this is one aspect of it. But on this, not everybody is actually going to have the opportunity to be able to move, you know, sort of thing. There's family connections. Maybe you can't get employment everywhere. And so it's a very costly action. But even if you kind of move with your feet aspect of sort of things, that's actually going to create great divides kind of within our country that we already kind of see, in which there's certain states where there are a lot more resources that, like, say, the state government is providing, and there's other states that aren't providing those resources. And now here we can probably have disagreement of opinion about how should these resources be allocated, but there could be just be a lot of people, and I don't think it's going to be an insubstantial number, who like, I just can't pick up and move. So locally, there's definitely geographic sorting by partisanship, where you may have more Democratic neighborhoods or Republican neighborhoods. And those types of moving is probably a little bit easier. There's increasing evidence that people are viewing sort of like, well, Missouri is a red state and I'm a Democrat, I'm not moving there, or vice versa. It's like, I'm from a more red state, I'm not moving to Massachusetts. So there's more evidence of that in terms of that aspect. But I think in terms of the moving or voting with your feet, that's a really costly action on the state level. It's a little less on the local level.
Well, so I live in the Washington, D.C. region, and there is a constant comparison within the region between Virginia and Maryland. Maryland lags in economic development. Virginia is ahead. But Virginia is red right now, while Maryland has become blue. So it is unclear where the inflow of people is, which side has the net inflow of people. And this comparison is constantly made within the region that, well, you know, where will people move to and what is going to be more attractive, the politics or the possibilities of economic development?
People are going to have those trade-offs everywhere. And so you can, like, if in this example you're presenting, it may be politics versus the economy. But here, like, I think more broadly, there's so many factors that can like decide why someone is going to move somewhere, in which, like, so here in St. Louis, I'm very fortunate that a large reason why I'm in St. Louis is that's where my family is, like, sort of thing. And then if like people are also going to make decisions, like in moving to the Southwest right now, it's like the water situation in the Southwest is very dire. And so here, like in terms of like kind of returning to the idea of accountability and your government representing you, Americans are probably focusing on many, many different topics, you know, sort of thing, or subject matters and their decisions to move. And so there may be other reasons why they just can't or aren't willing to.
How does your understanding of accountability intersect with the polarization? You know, we talked about geographic sorting a little bit.
The lack of accountability in state legislatures, I do think, probably does contribute to the level of polarization that we have, and maybe increasingly so. So here to kind of explain it a little bit, probably the strongest evidence I have of this within the book is that I don't only just look at the general election, but I look at the primary election. And so here, for those who haven't read the book yet, I establish, at least I think I provide a substantial amount of evidence that state legislators are held accountable in the general election for their roll call record, but the punishment is pretty darn small. And so they do get punished if they don't necessarily represent their districts, but the punishment isn't very big.
What do you mean by small punishment versus big punishment?
Here, what I do is I conduct an analysis where I estimate, say, a legislator's ideology based off their roll call record. And then additionally, I have another estimate of the ideology of the district. And then I examine the extent to which, like, okay, as the legislator maybe become less like the district or more distant from the district, what happens to them in the general election? And so here, what we may think is that, okay, if a legislator is more distant from the district ideologically, then the district should be unhappier with the, say, the legislator's representation. And then say through like this idea of accountability, it's like, I will then punish someone for doing not representing me as well as they could. And so then what I find is that pretty much if you go like what is known as like a standard deviation, like away from, say, the legislator's ideology, increase it. A standard deviation is a pretty healthy chunk of misrepresentation. And then here, that standard deviation increase results in only about less than 1% of vote share decrease. So here, a state legislator can come substantially more extreme and then only lose about 1% of the vote. Now, there's many elections where 1% of the vote can decide it, but they're not that many. And so here, that there is this electoral punishment, but it's not that large in the general election.
Do you see differences between states? Which are states where there are where there is more accountability and where there is less accountability?
No. So, yeah, I do find evidence that there's differences across states, particularly kind of in the ingredients that kind of help us get accountability. So here are kind of those key ingredients that I want to kind of talk about is like knowledge and challenger entry. But those are going to be rooted a little bit more in the amount of media coverage of state legislatures, how polarized state legislatures are, and then additionally, how professional state legislatures are. And in here, I'll explain a little bit more in a bit, but professionalism is like, how much staff does the state legislature have? How much do you pay the state legislators themselves? So kind of focusing on the first topic, I do find that in states with more reporters devoted to state house, state government, then the voters are more knowledgeable about that state government. So they're more likely to know which party kind of controls the state legislature. Some of the states with the fewest amount of reporters are like Wyoming and Alaska, but then the states with the most amount of reporters are probably unsurprisingly like New York, California, and Texas. And Maryland is about just in the middle in terms of how many reporters, at least relatively, there are covering state government. And so here, if Maryland had more reporters, I would expect more people to be knowledgeable about the Maryland state legislature. There are more positive things happening on the reporter front. And so that in this, there's an organization called States Newsroom. And what States Newsroom is a national organization. It's a nonprofit. But what it does is it tries to raise money and help fund and provide infrastructure for state level like entities that are covering state government. So here, for example, I have in Missouri, the Missouri Independent, which is about 4 to 6 reporters who are of extremely high quality. And then in this is a free online publication. And then in it, I subscribe to their newsletter. And so I get it every morning in my inbox. But they also, newspapers like the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or Kansas City Star, they can pick up their articles, to my knowledge, for very little cost, if any cost. So here, this importance of reporters is that one reporter can only do so much, but they can also stimulate other news coverage itself, therefore informing the voter, letting them be able to hold them more accountable.
I want to give a shout out to Maryland Matters, which is part of the State's Newsroom here, and they do phenomenal work.
The local newspaper or local news station is struggling. It is much cheaper for them to run a story that they got from the AP that's a national story that's not local. And so here, concerned citizens, I just kind of like giving this plug, support your local media, because if you don't, then the people in government or even outside of government aren't having, say, a watchdog on them. And that is very much needed.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Let's talk about one-party domination. Right? Jurisdictions where one party is so dominant, such as where I live in Montgomery County, if you are within the Democratic left, then really there is no threat to you.
That is a big part of the lack of accountability story. And so here, so you, like you and I both are in a district, like, so I'm in St. Louis City. There's no way that there's very little chance a Republican is ever going to win my district, that sort of thing. So here, for example, for listeners, I'm represented by Cori Bush. And then this used to be Dick Gephardt's district, who used to be the minority leader in the U.S. House. And so here, Democrats are going to win at U.S. House level. But I think this is a really important point to kind of say how this accountability problem has actually probably gotten a little worse over the last 20 years. So, for example, we are familiar with this idea of gerrymandering or redistricting, where districts may be drawn such that to really favor one of the parties. And this is done at the U.S. House level, and it's also done at the state house level, but it's being done increasingly so. So, for example, if we were just going to consider state house districts, and then kind of let's classify for sake of example that a close district is going to be one where the two parties pretty much get 45 to 55% of the vote. So this is a little bit more competitive. A Democrat could probably win or a Republican could probably win. And so in this definition of a close district, back in 2000, about 25% of state house districts could be classified as close. If we jump to 2012, this falls to about 20%. And then with the 2022 redistricting, this falls to 15%. So in the span of about 20 years, we went from about 25% of state house districts being close to only 15% being close. And then here, this isn't just happening. They're all becoming Democrat. They're all becoming Republican. Pretty much they're increasing about, say, 7 to 8% on both the Democrat and Republican side in creating more partisan districts, like those who are more 60% or more for one party. And so here, as you kind of pointed out, like in a place like your district or my district that are very Democratic, there's no way a Republican's going to win. And so in this, if then the Democrat who's in office knows that they pretty much can't lose, at least in the general election, then they may be incentivized to kind of do whatever they want a little bit more. And in here, this returns to an earlier question that you brought up in terms of polarization. And then in these, because we have all these more partisan districts, what I do find is that in these partisan districts, what legislators actually have is they have more of an interest to be extreme because they also have to survive a primary election. Cori Bush primaried out Lacey Clay. So Lacey Clay was a representative for a very long time. Before that, his William Clay was his father, was representative for a very long time. But then Cori Bush came into this district, tacked Clay from the left and won. And that was at the U.S. House level. And then here in accountability in state legislatures, I do show that these more extreme legislators are going to be more successful in these partisan districts, which is troubling if we're worried about polarization.
So one of the consequences of one-party domination is said to be that the venue of political contestation changes from inter-party to intra-party. And I think you described that. Can there be accountability?
I don't think it's impossible because here again, I'm sorry, drawing from the state of Missouri right now, we are Senate and the House, the state House, state Senate, very Republican. And what you're describing is the exact story of like the Missouri state Senate, in which the Missouri state Senate is healthily Republican, but there's a more conservative caucus and there's a more moderate or traditional Republican caucus. We are a weird state where we don't technically have the filibuster, but we respect it. There has been a lot of filibusters kind of within the Missouri State Senate on everything from especially on redistricting, but on also sports betting or abortion bills or education bills, tying these things up. And so in terms of this like one party dominance, I actually think it probably creates more complications, not necessarily for accountability, partly because the accountability, we're already such in a bad spot anyway. It's like, okay, throw our hands up a little bit. But on representation side, it really does kind of muck things up, I think, in legislatures. And here, like, we're kind of seeing it a little bit in terms of the U.S. House. And so with this, like Kevin McCarthy being ousted by, say, a small faction within his party.
Let's talk a little bit about the elites. We've been talking about voting. Let's talk about elites a little bit. Who runs? Why do they run? And what are the consequences in terms of accountability?
So here, just to give you some top line statistics about the number of people running. So this is data coming from 2001 to 2020, looking at single member districts. So only where one candidate could win, because there's some states, including Maryland, I believe, that have multi-member districts. In single member districts, 83% of incumbents who ran for re-election did not face a primary challenger. So only 17% face a primary challenger. 45% did not face a general election challenger. So almost half, we're at 45% of races in the general election in single member districts. So Maryland, you're doing a little better because you didn't only have multiple candidates happening.
Well, I'll make a correction here, because 41% of the Montgomery County delegation to the state is actually appointed by the district central committee, that they run on as slates. So they are even harder to remove. You can't even primary them.
Different states with multi-member districts have so many different rules to these things. And so I'll concede a shortcoming of accountability in state legislatures, I apologize, is I don't examine multi-member districts as much.
To what extent do your conclusions apply to local politics as opposed to state politics?
I actually don't think my conclusions apply as like what a lot of people may jump to as much to local politics. Local politics does suffer, as I said earlier, from lack of media coverage and potentially lack of challengers or people being involved in government. But here, I do think, like, so actually when I was writing the book, I kind of came up with this phrase, but I didn't use it a little bit. Like, there's this donut hole of accountability in state legislatures, in which research has found evidence of accountability in U.S. House elections more than I have. And it's actually, I would argue, they found more evidence of accountability in local elections than I have, whether it be for crime, school boards, like testing scores, or even potholes.
We didn't talk at all about, you know, things like ranked choice voting, open primaries.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think those institutional mechanisms can help?
So here I have investigated in terms of open and closed primaries. They actually don't seem to do too much. Like, so here I have worked both on representation and in accountability, in which in representation, it's not in the book, but it's in another piece where open and closed primaries don't really seem to affect too much whether you get. So maybe I should step back and explain. So here, what an open primary is like what we have here in Missouri, where I can show up on primary election day as a Democrat and I can vote in the Republican primary if I just so choose. And so here I can just walk up and they just ask me, what ballot do you want? I say the Democrat or Republican. And so I can vote in a Republican primary, even though I'm a Democrat. In a closed primary, what this is that typically you have to be pre-registered with a party. And then when you go, you basically, like, you're already registered. And if I was a registered Democrat, I could only vote in the Democratic primary.
Like Maryland.
Like, okay, great. Yeah. So we're a different, like, yeah. And here I have to say it when I show up, but it can be anything. And so this is kind of the difference between open and closed primaries. And then theoretically, what some people have speculated is like, well, if I have a closed primary, like in Maryland, then what is going to be the case is then you're going to have these pre-registered voters who probably have more of a strong party affiliation. And at least in terms of representation, then they may elect more extreme candidates. Meanwhile, an open primary, there could be someone like, my name's Steve. I am a Democrat in a red state. I concede as a Democrat, I have voted in a Republican primary because it didn't matter on the Democrat side, but I was hoping to get a different Republican. And so then here, I could maybe as a Democrat hop over into the Republican primary and maybe moderate out or get a more liberal Republican there. But in work I have with Boris Shore, Nolan McCarty, and Seth Maskett, I do find that there's not much difference in terms of representation there, like in terms of selecting more extreme candidates. So the theoretical concerns, at least empirically, are not supported. And in terms of accountability in the book, I also do look like, is there a difference in the levels of accountability or how much do legislators get rewarded for extremity in open or closed? And I actually don't find much evidence either. So at least on that side of things, in open and closed primaries, they're not doing a whole lot, at least from the data that we have.
Stephen Rogers, thank you for taking the time. I hope everybody reads your book.
Great. Thank you very much for having me today.
You're listening to I Hate Politics. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I'll be back with the wrap-up, including lessons from my conversation with Stephen Rogers of St. Louis University and the author of the book, Accountability in State Legislatures. You're listening to I Hate Politics. I am Sunil Dasgupta. What lessons can we draw from my conversation with Stephen Rogers, author of the book Accountability in State Legislatures. Rogers' argument about the lack of accountability covers a range of hot-button issues. Political polarization, ideological sorting into states and neighborhoods, gerrymandering, incumbency, barriers to challengers, single-party rule, and much more. But if we want to go to the root of the problem, we have to talk about news coverage. Information and its refined version, knowledge, is a necessary condition for political accountability. As gridlock at the federal level has pushed decisions to state and local governments, we have to know more about those governments to be able to hold political leaders accountable. But the instruments of this knowledge building have declined dramatically over the years. As Stephen Rogers points out, there are more credentialed reporters at the Super Bowl than all of U.S. state houses put together. Rogers makes the observation that knowledge about state politics is a particular donut hole. There is more information about the federal government on one side and more information about local government on the other. The particular hole in state politics, it seems, is really a mismatch between the vast workings of the state government and the truly meager reporting resources devoted to it, which leaves swaths of government policy uncovered and unreported on. If this is the case, it is worth taking a step back to look at the problem of declining local and state news coverage itself. With the decline of the traditional for-profit, independent company-owned news outlets, we see three models in state and local news ownership. First, as Rogers mentions, the nonprofit model typified by the state's newsroom, which in Maryland is represented by the incredible Maryland Matters. Nonprofit news is funded mainly by readers and listeners and charitable groups such as the Knight Foundation. Second, privately owned, but without the expectation of profit. In Montgomery County, Moco 360, the website formerly known as Bethesda Beat, falls into this category, at least according to its owner, Scott Copeland, who was on the show a couple of months ago. And then there is social media-based for-profit news, which in Montgomery County is represented by the Moco Show, which reaches hundreds of thousands with small, quick bites of local news, which it combines with advertising and entertainment, but its political reporting mainly recycles local government press releases. This model is the only one that is profitable at this time, and they have very little state government coverage. I Hate Politics offers a fourth model: news that is academically embedded within educational institutions and functioning independently within the scope of academic freedom. Many universities and high schools already run newspapers, radio and television stations, and internet sites and podcasts. It is interesting to note that in Montgomery County, the largest newsroom belongs to Montgomery Blair High School's student newspaper, Silver Chips. In 2022, the paper had 80 staffers. One of the most interesting recent takes on the issue comes from Washington, D.C. Council member Janice Lewis George, who has proposed a bill for government funding of local media in the city. Based on the coolness with which it was received, government funding for local media appears to be some ways away. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer Daniel Galeo, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. composer, songwriter, and pianist Oren Levine. We are pulling music from his album Making Up for Lost Time. Barbara Papendrop and Aaron Myers on vocals, Lionel Lyles on tenor sax, and Herb Scott on alto sax. You can find more music from Oren Levine at ohljazz.com. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihbpod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time.